But before we turn to agriculture, I'm just going to mention, since everyone is talking about the U.S. situation and the Trump issue, whichever way you see it, I'm going to recommend you see Atlantic Magazine in an article by James Mattis. He's a retired U.S. general, and his comments and conversation on that whole Trump and the U.S. situation. Well, the key numbers this week in the crop report are 96, 92, and 93, and we'll get to that report. But previously, we posted quoted documents about the apparent insolvency of Morris Industries and associated businesses. But with Alvarez and Marshall Canada appointed as the monitor to the Morris Group restructuring, the monitor is conducting meetings with the company and apparently with prospective buyers, including Right Way Manufacturing of Regina. And On the Land reported earlier that the monitor hopes to conclude a potential sale of the Morris assets by the end of June. The company received bankruptcy protection in January, pending attempts to downsize and restructure. Now, the receiver, or in this case the monitor, Alvarez and Marshall, has applied successfully to the courts for a publication ban on court filings to date. On the Land will respect that ruling and will return to the story when appropriate. Well, All You Ever Wanted to Know doesn't have much to say about birds this week, but bees, another matter.
The spring is a big time when they get ready to, when they swarm. If they run out of room in a hive, that's the main issue, is they run out of room in their hive and then they swarm. So overpopulation of bees in a hive without enough space.
Well, that's a part of a conversation with a bee man hobbyist, Stan Reed, part of All You Ever Wanted to Know about things in the agriculture world. And talk about variability, Sask Water puts out an advisory for the Churchill River Basin, as the north part of our province is very wet. A dry spring to date, but research plots just south of Yorkton seem to be doing well, says Mike Hall of the East Central Research Foundation. And Cam Dahl with Sirius Canada confirms export programs have been in high gear and still another indicator of rural road traffic. And how about a foliar plant enhancer drawn from the, wait for it, recycled household batteries that we discard? All that in this hour ahead. And in addition to that, the Arberg Oat Challenge on the Land. Well, according to Sask Water, conditions have been particularly wet from Montreal Lake to LaRonge and over to Hatchet Lake, where rainfall accumulations have been 200 to 250% of normal in the past month. Stream flows are now 2 to 3 times normal for this time of year in the north into the Churchill River. The control structure at LaRonge has been fully open since May 26, the water advisory says. The lake is above normal levels and continuing to rise in response to above normal inflows. Now, the number, an elevation of 364.40 meters on June 3rd, that puts Lac La Ronge at the top of its desirable operating range, again, according to the Water Watcher people at Sask Water. Now, here in East Central Saskatchewan, the 8th driest May in the past 110 years, that says the Environment Canada Weather Record Book, Yorkton having its 6th driest combined 3-month period, March, April, and May. EnviroCan says parts of southeast Saskatchewan, though, are having their driest spring on record. Regina 75% below normal, the 4th driest on record for the March-May period. At Estevan, the driest on record in 89 years, 31 millimeters or 30% of normal. But the usual variability remains, including a few frost hits last week. Just south of the city, Mike Hall manages the East Central Research Farm site, where he says soil moisture conditions remain decent.
We're doing well. I think we always seem to do well. We've got a nice site here. We've got wheat at the, probably leaf stage, if not a little more than that, probably 5. And I'd say most of our cereals are right now are between 3 and 5 leaf stage out there, depending upon when they were seeded. So yeah, things are looking fairly good. You know, it is a little bit dry, but I think there are drier areas in the area than us, that's for sure.
More from Mike Hall on the East Central Research Farm Project still ahead on this program. Just a couple of other notes. Swift Current, 58% of normal moisture, their 25th driest record on record. Saskatoon, 22% below normal for the precipitation. Now, Weyburn Crop Extension Specialist Sherry Roberts, on the other hand, says there are pockets in the southeast where moisture is not a big concern this spring.
This is really funny because it's so variable. I live in the Glen Avon area, and we've had some beautiful rains come through. Last week, in fact, we had rains on Friday night, Thursday night, and even yesterday we had a brief shower come through. We are in really good shape here, but I'm hearing that things are real dry in Estevan area and even south of Weyburn once again. And there's a pocket, I believe, just northeast of Weyburn, too, that they're showing pretty dry. But here, where I live, our soil moisture is really good. But as it sounds like it's going to be another one of those years where the storms are going to pass through in certain areas and they're going to be blessed with the moisture, and other people are going to be frustrated and maybe not get what they really need.
That again, Sherry Roberts with the Ag Ministry. And again, some of her pastures are in ideal conditions, not so much elsewhere. Well, we mentioned the numbers 96, 92, and 93%. 96% of the Saskatchewan crop was planted as of Monday this week, just ahead of the five-year average, which is 92%. 99% of the crop is seeded in the southwest. Precipitation, as we've been saying, and this week was no exception, very little, especially in this central and southern area of which we would be included. And, of course, the dryness and strong winds reducing topsoil moisture. Some rainfall in some areas a couple of weeks ago is helping the west side with pasture conditions, but they're going to need it too. Now, cropland topsoil moisture is rated as 1% surplus. That's provincially 65% adequate, 30% short, and 4% very short. On the other hand, hay and pasture land topsoil moisture on a provincial basis, 58% adequate, 32% short, and 10% very short. So again, we remind ourselves those are averages and should be taken that way. Now, the East Central region of which we are part, Crop Districts 5 and 6A, fair to good condition for the majority of crops is the assessment as of Monday by the crop reporters. And 93% of seeding complete again. That's up from 69% last week. Lipton and just south of Humboldt did get some rain, 14 millimeters. Siemens and Craik, 1 millimeter. Saul Coates, my little hometown, 3 millimeters. Craven, 5. Goody, Foam Lake, Wynyard, 6 millimeters. Calvington, the big rainfall winter this week in this region at 54 millimeters, that's close to 2 inches. So as always, it's every year it's the same. There are some dry places. There are some places that are in much better shape. And again, the majority of crops in the region, according to the crop reporter's assessment, is fair to good condition. Strong winds, dry soils, yeah, nasty flea beetles, and even some light frost have been part of the last week's picture. Seeding, spraying, some harvesting still going on, and everyone's favorite pastime, picking stones. You're listening to On the Land from The Rock. We're back with more in a moment. Well, today we begin our spring program of I get to drive around and hopefully talk to some farmers, socially distanced, of course, and we have some goodies for the folks, including coffee and muffins from McDonald's here in Yorkton. We'll tell you more about that. Now, our buddy Harry Siemens often is with us during the program, not available today, but the crop report from Manitoba is pretty much like ours. High winds, frost May 30th is hurt and delaying crops in some areas. Emergence suffering in some places with dry surface soils. Elsewhere, wet or saturated subsurface soils are impacting crop emergence. And, of course, there's those hungry flea beetles feasting ever and even faster on plants weakened by frost and wind. Well, John Duvenot of Wild Oats Publishing this week observes that pea exports are flying out the door, with Chinese fractionators the biggest customer. Production, says Duvenot, is forecast to rise modestly this year, and the carryover is rising. Lentil exports are booming this year. Carryover stocks are shrinking as the Canadian crop gets used. Chickpea production will shrink this year, is John's comment. Now, other positive news for the pulse industry, with indications that India's lentil 30% tariff may be cut to 10% at least in the short term. Steep tariffs on pulse imports into India have been in place since November 2017. Although the Indian Ministry of Finance has publicly posted its intent to lower the levies, Pulse Canada cautiously awaits some clarification on the exact wording. Chairman Greg Cherwick.
Generally speaking, the interpretation could be that the reduction could either take effect immediately and apply to goods that arrive prior to August 31st, 2020, or it could apply to goods that land after August 31st. So until we get that clarified, I'd be reluctant to say anything more than that government has signaled there will be a reduction in the duty applied to imported lentils, but the timing and the application of that policy change really aren't clear yet.
Well, with rampant food prices and inflation, the Indian government has provided 1 kilogram of free pulses per family during the COVID-19 lockdown.
That has led to a bit of a depletion of the buffer stocks that they had for pulses, and it would certainly appear that domestic prices in the market are responding to that tightening. So you've got this balance to achieve that has you hypersensitive to the needs of that very politically powerful rural constituency, and you've also got to be mindful of the need to make sure that you've got affordable and available staple sources of protein for, in many cases, the most vulnerable segment of your population. So this does lead to changes in policy that happen on a very short-term basis, and they happen very quickly.
That again, Greg Cherwick with Pulse Canada. He's hopeful that all the tariff reduction details will become public in the next day or two. We might still hear today. Now, in spite of the current 30% tariff, India has purchased about 400,000 tons of Canadian lentils in the current crop year. Well, on the upside of exports, Canadian wheat and durum exports have been moving well in recent weeks as some countries beef up food supplies during the pandemic. Longer term, though, there are concerns that the pandemic will force countries to look inward, protecting domestic food production behind trade barriers. Cereals Canada President Cam Dahl hopeful the COVID-19 pandemic will not encourage more such barriers. But some countries use those measures to avoid obligations in trade agreements. Dahl says India and Italy are examples, with new ones appearing in smaller countries like Thailand and Vietnam.
We saw before the pandemic started a growing sense of economic nationalism, and you just have to look south of the border to see that. That really has accelerated because of COVID-19. We're seeing countries really revert to, internal supply first, putting up protectionist trade barriers. So Italy is an example of that. That's a long-standing trade dispute with country of origin labeling. But we're also seeing barriers come up in Vietnam, for example, that is essentially closed to Canadian grain and oilseed exports at this time because of thistle seeds. While those concerns really aren't founded on science, they're a trade barrier. So I'm concerned that we're going to see more and more of those as time goes on. It really is going to become, I think, one of the leading issues we face.
Well, Cam Dahl is concerned about a return to more economic nationalism in the future, led, of course, by the United States.
They're protecting their own food supply. And again, another example of that, of course, is India. It doesn't apply to wheat in this case, but having a significant impact on Canada's ability to export our pulse crops. There's that protectionist and nationalistic element of protecting their own industry and trying to protect their own food supply. I don't think it's good policy, but...
Cam Dahl adds he thinks we're going to see more of the same.
At this time, Canada is supplying 60% of the world's trade in durum. So if Italy wanted to buy durum wheat, they really had no choice but to come to Canada. But at the same time, we do need to have a policy pivot from our governments. Up until you know, I would say 2 or 3 years ago, we spent a lot of energy negotiating trade agreements, whether that's the TPP or the EU agreement or renegotiating NAFTA. And that was a good thing. But now we need to ensure that those agreements are working for us and that when countries violate those agreements or at least violate the spirit of those agreements, that our government really aggressively protects our trade interests. And Italy's just another example. We should have taken that case to the WTO.
And just my personal footnote on that comment, for whatever his politics may or may not have been, the former Ag Minister Jerry Ritz was a big proponent of getting those trade deals in place. Well, to complicate things further, U.S. President Trump so far has refused to appoint a member to a World Dispute Committee.
Yeah, and that's a symptom of that broader growth in protectionism, that broader growth in what I call economic nationalism. The official dispute resolution process has stalled because of that, and there are judges that the U.S. is refusing to allow to be appointed. Unfortunately, there's, led by Canada, a number of countries have come together to carry on with the dispute resolution process. Well, this issue is worked out, but that's not a permanent solution. We do need to find re-engagement in these international forums, and that needs to become a much bigger focus for the government of Canada. We need to be going out and addressing some of these non-tariff trade barriers as we see them coming, not after vessels start being blocked.
Well, a major challenge, of course, is keeping those issues front and center during a time of COVID and other distractions.
It's really difficult, but we really do need to do that. It, of course, you know, travel is difficult, so if an issue is coming up in Thailand, for example, that's not hypothetical. Thailand is banning a number of pesticides that are going to cause trade disruptions. It's difficult to get an official from the CFIA on a plane to go to Thailand to meet with the government there. But we are going to need this to be a real focus for government agencies.
So that again was Cam Dahl. He's president with Cereals Canada based in Winnipeg. Well, to get that grain to market that Cam was just talking about, let's start with roads. This week, $28 million provincial dollars added to a rural roads project in 36 municipalities. The program will cover up to 50% of total project costs to a maximum of $500,000. A three-year plan with the Saskatchewan Association of Rural Municipalities to improve 100 rural roads.
Out there, you know, agriculture is not slowing down. Farmers are out there either still struggling trying to get some of their crops off or seeding, and at the same time they're hauling grain, you know, to grain elevators to try and pay the bills. So things are really busy out there right now.
SARM President Ray Orb. Well, we need to ask if you're ready for turning the contents of flashlight batteries into ag products is on your radar, and then spraying them on your precious fields. Ready or not, here comes Finland-based Trace Grow. Dan Eberhardt with Eberhardt Ag Solutions, farmer entrepreneurs in Langenberg, and their company have applied over 1 million acres of Biosol. That's a recycled sulfur-based product. And they've spread it on Western Canadian farmland, the carrier being recycled food waste. But next, says Eberhardt, Trace Grow has developed foliar fertilizer products derived from used household-type alkaline batteries.
This is a product that my brother was privy to at the Agritechnica show in November, when back when people could still get together in close proximity and shake hands and hug and all that good stuff that we miss these days. But anyhow, he saw this product at Agritechnica. He was very excited about it. He told me about it, and we've been looking into it ever since. And now we're bringing it to Canada to essentially ask the check writers if this is something that would benefit them and their crops. And we think as people trial it, they'll come to understand it's, you know, a benefit. But what it is, it's a highly soluble, easily tank mixable, 100% certified organic source of it's certified in Europe, organic certified in Europe, source of zinc and manganese that comes in a jug. You can throw it in your sprayer tank. And of course, zinc and manganese are great micronutrient pair for virtually any crop, and it's something that's deficient in certain soils and in crops around the world and in the human population and their diet. But the real kicker about this product is that it's made from recycled batteries. So in every one of these 10-liter jugs, there is 250 recycled batteries. And you know, people don't realize it, but there's a ton of this black mass, they call it, that's coming out of batteries, especially in places like Europe where these things are tightly controlled, that normally would just get thrown out and now can be repurposed to actually be a nutrient for crops, which in turn leads to nutrient-dense crops for the end user, which is the shopper, the person in the household that's purchasing the groceries for the whole family. And what I think is really unique about this, I mean, our big long-term 30,000-foot vision for the future is that at some point, it won't just be a circular economy from materials that would normally be landfilled to becoming nutrients. They'll actually be tracked down to the kitchen table, where people are concerned about, you know, which product they buy relative to nutrient density, because armies of grocery shoppers are soon to be equipped, apparently, with nutrient density scanners. So they'll actually know what's in their food down to the nutrient density level.
Well, I'd like to ask more about that, but I just need to back up a second, Dan. We're talking about a product derived from batteries, and we're calling it organic. There's a disconnect there for me.
Yeah, that's the crazy part. And so I can't really speak for the classification in Europe, but obviously they would have as stringent parameters as we would here in Canada. And we're going to look into the ability for us to sell it to the organic market. But really where we're interested in selling it to is a conventional farmer here in Canada. We want, you know, just like my brother, you know, would be considered a conventional farmer. We want sustainable, you know, circular economy tools that make sense economically and logistically for producers to do here. We want to have the sustainability easy button for producers here in Canada. So whether we'll be able to get it certified organic here in Canada or not, I mean, we'd love to. We'll look at that market. I think it's significant that the EU essentially has approved this as an organic market product. And the company that's producing it just won an award in business and innovation as well. So the bottom line is there that the point that I'm trying to make with those credentials is these people are professionals producing a clean, safe product that's been accepted over there as a good fit in business and in agronomy, and we're looking to bring it to Canada. But we want to know, we're essentially bringing the level of product over that we're asking people in our network to try some out and see what it does for them. We're going to be doing trials with it. We want to know what kind of market it is, you know, is available for it here in Canada, so we could bring it to the masses.
So I guess the bottom line is, if the Europeans say it's organic, is that it?
Keep it simple, Jack. I mean, those folks over there are ahead on the road to where things are going, whether we like it or not. You know, there's elements of the whole sustainability value chain that one might rightly question and ask, is that actually doing good? Just, you know, earlier we were talking about maybe the philosophical or it could be scientific point about, are electric cars good for the environment? Well, that is the way the world is going right now. That is the opportunity for some, and for some, they'll get left behind if they don't jump on. Now, are today's electric cars completely the answer? Probably not. Will tomorrow's cars be better? Likely. In our philosophy, as long as we're moving in the right direction incrementally without starving the population and inducing mass panic and pain and suffering, like as long as we're incrementally getting better at what we do at feeding the world, you know, we're not asking, we don't want anybody to give up any of the tools that they're currently using. We're using all the modern tools on our own farm. But we recognize that we have to move in a certain direction to do things better. And we need to make it sustainable economically and logistically for producers to do it, because we have to win the hearts and minds of our customers, which is the people at the grocery table. And if we can tell somebody at the Sobeys, you know, when they're walking through the aisle at Sobeys, hey, this is a product that was produced in the most sustainable manner. In fact, it's fortified with zinc from recycled batteries. I mean, you might wonder about the taste of it, but as people get their heads around this, you know, it's not going to taste like a battery. It's going to taste like a wonderful piece of fruit or vegetable that's been made in such a way that we could all be proud. And the bottom line is, Jack, this is where I'm coming from. This is the bottom line. You got to recognize a generation or two from now, people will look back in horror at who we were throwing out half of what we produced. It's not going to continue. It's inevitable that we will use more and more of what we produce, reconstitute it in other ways. It just has to happen because it's common sense.
So this, again, is a conversation with Dan Eberhardt with Eberhardt Ag Solutions. The Finnish company and their products can claim up to 27% yield increase in field trials and, quote, TraceGrow complies with all terms of European fertilizer legislation, something that Dan was making. Now, the TraceGrow liquid concentrate is mixed with water, sprayed on wheat, oats, barley, and grass, and they will experiment this year with foliar applications to wine grapes and rice.
Yeah, our sulfur levels have been rising in our soils and in our plant tissue tests in the 5 years we've been using Biosol, even as, you know, all the trends for our major crops have been going up in yield. We've been showing higher yields over the last 5 years, and it's a combination of a bunch of things, not just Biosol. But interestingly enough, one of the nutrients that were showing up to be somewhat deficient over time was zinc and manganese. Now, will we get a response? That's the kind of thing that we want to see. But when we're deficient in a nutrient, this would be a way to apply it. You can either apply it early on, once in the season, I would say, at herbicide timing. You throw it in with your herbicides, or you can throw it in with your fungicides, or you could do both if you want to do split application. Right now, the recommended rate is about a liter per acre. It's going to be just under $10 an acre to apply this, and you should see a return. My brother talks about getting a 3-to-1 return. So that's something where, you know, if you get 3 or 4 or 5 bushels of something because of the extra juice, perfect, away you go. The other application is that you can actually spray it on or coat conventionally granulated fertilizer with it. So it could be something that goes down with the seed, and that's something that a lot of producers are now doing, as putting down, you know, products like MESZ or adding some zinc to the fertilizer mix. So bottom line is, you should see a result by putting it in your sprayer tanks, as easy as that. When we bring some product in here, we're going to be getting it towards the end of June, and we're going to be running social media campaign and webinar, as we usually do, making people aware of the opportunity. And we like to see people throw in a couple jugs at the end of the field and check those test strips, you know, check your tissue tests.
Now, the originating Finnish company says ZM Grow also has been tried in the U.S. field experiments for tomatoes, cotton, and avocados. Well, inevitably, Jack had to ask, what's next at Eberhardt Ag Solutions?
But we are working on a product that the inventor of Biosol has come up with. It's a new product. It's relatively limited availability right now, but it's called Replenish. And so this is actually a phosphate that combines a micronized phosphorus with the elemental sulfur in the compost. So what we're talking about is biological production of fertility versus, you know, the synthetic high salt typical version everybody's using. But this is a phos molecule that's being liberated by bugs that feed on iron and they feed on sulfur, creating acidulation, liberating this phos. It can also be spread on top. So through the micronization of the phos, it can physically move down through the soil profile, being, you know, about the size of average pore size of soil. Also, you're getting these bugs that are working on the phos to make it available. So I think we're going to see different versions of Biosol going forward. Biosol with potash, this Replenish, which is going to be a phos product, and we'll be able to put other things in it. But sometimes, you know, you can make cherry Coca-Cola, but the original Coca-Cola is pretty damn good, and really, It's been working over millions of acres now. It's completely unique in the market.
That, again, a conversation with Dan Eberhardt of Eberhardt Ag Solutions. A story we'll be coming back to just in the recycling out of Saskatoon this week with the university coming up with a working on a process with the light source there, recycling human waste for fertilizers, which of course isn't a new concept. Well, the surge of interest and the necessity to cook and eat at home through the pandemic still translates into demand for more oat products. That from the lead grain buyer at Grain Millers in Yorkton, Scott Shields.
Products are definitely one of those staples that people need for whether they're baking oatmeal cookies or oat cakes or just having oatmeal in the morning. We've seen a lot of that. We've seen the cereal companies, the bar manufacturers, they're all still pushing as well because that ready-to-eat stuff is, those products are still kind of flying off the store shelves.
Scott Shields notes that oat prices have reacted to the demand surge.
Recently, there's been a pretty good uptick in old crop pricing. We're paying $4 a bushel right now for summer delivery for oats. We haven't seen $4 oats around this area for a while. And even new crop is pushed higher. We're up over $3 into the new year. Attractive pricing for farmers, and definitely back to the point now where, especially in this area where we see great yields a lot of the time, great quality oats, those kind of dollars can make oats a really profitable crop for growers in the area.
Well, with the seeding near completion, plus the likelihood of empty oat bins by fall, Shields stands by his 10% increase predicted in oat acres this year.
And then we saw some Ag Canada numbers that say maybe only 5-6% increase. Now, I think I'm still sticking pretty hard with my 10. I think with, there was some issue in areas getting the last year's crop off still, even, up until, I think there's still some combines in the field. Those acres are getting late to be seeding other crops. We could see some of those go into oats, as well as a lot of acres in southern Manitoba that were going to be seeded to corn that now there's talk that they're too late to put corn in, and they're going to be looking at other cereals, so wheat, oats, or barley. We'd love to see it go into oats. Of course, that's very selfish of me to say, but more oats, the merrier. We could see that 10 might even be a little bit low.
Well, as a bit of a diversion in these uncertain times, Grain Millers has come up with an oat grower challenge centered around the variety Arberg oats.
So back in the early winter, we got talking with folks in the marketing department at FP Genetics, the seed company that owns CDC Arberg, one of the newest varieties of oats that's out there. And they were interested in doing some kind of a promotion for the variety if it indeed turned out to be a good enough milling variety for us, which it has in subsequent months. We did an IP mill run on it, and everything turned out really good. And with what we know about it, we were confident in doing a promotion for a variety specific challenge. So what we've done, basically any grower that has certified Arberg seed in the ground this year and has a contract with us, whether it's for one load or 50 loads, can register for the challenge. It's free. You just basically let us know that you're interested in being part of it. And what we're going to do, we're going to try and do some signage. We're going to try, try and do a little bit of promotion of a variety that way. And at the end of the day, between yield and the grain quality when it comes to us, as well as nutritional lab quality on the milled product, we're going to take, there's a scoring process that'll be put in effect at that point. And the top three, I believe it's the top two conventional growers and the top organic grower of Arberg by this criteria, will win a trip for two to the Prairie Oat Growers Conference in Banff this December. Providing the world goes back to somewhat normal and we all can go to Banff. That's it in a nutshell. So we've got a pretty good little group of registrants so far. and what seeding is done. We're going to kind of hit the phones and be updating on varieties with our contracted growers and looking for more. The more the merrier, kind of in a thing like this. And it came at a great time where everybody could use something a little bit fun. And we've never done anything like this. So we're really looking forward to getting out there, seeing some of the crops. We'll have our field rep out. She'll be visiting all these fields throughout the summer. And take it from there, have a little fun. You know, talk to a couple guys too that, you know, they got a buddy that's got some, and they're both going to be in the challenge, and they got some side bets, you know, on and stuff like that too. So I think we've really brought something a little bit fun in a less than fun time in our lives. So
as far as Arbor Goats, story on Arbor Goats, what makes them a special variety?
So it's a good yielder, great standability, compared with other new varieties that are out there. I'm not going to say that it's better, but it is one of the best we've seen in a long time. Nutritionally as well, for us, we're always looking at it. It's got to work for the farmer to get them to grow it, but at the end of the day, then it's got to work for us as well. So it mills well and has good beta-glucan levels, which is super important. You know, beta-glucan is the dietary fiber that food companies want to are able to put their heart healthy claim on the oat products because of higher beta-glucan levels. So Arbor has that, and that's one of the real important things for us and important things for the market on the other end.
That again, Scott Shields, he's the manager of procurement with Grain Millers in Yorkton. CDC Arbor Goats was named in 2017 to honor the hometown of well-known and respected seed industry professional Ron Wyke. But you see, there was a problem. Now, as Western producer, editor, writer, photographer, and farmer Mike Rain wrote at the time, for phonetic reasons, the new oat couldn't be named after Ron Wyke because Wyke, W-E-I-K, is too close in spelling to another word spelled W-E-A-K, and no farmer wants to be planting weak oats. So as a result, the new milling oat would be called CDC Arberg, the rural Manitoba community where Ron Wyke grew up. Wyke's career started with Sask Wheat Pool. He remained there till 2003. He worked for Quality Assure Seeds and FP Genetics. As well as a lot of involvement in the Canadian seed trade. Now, unfortunately, Ron Wyke passed away in 2018. The town of Arbourg lies in the heart of the Manitoba Interlakes, great oat-growing country. I knew Ron Wyke. He was a super fine gentleman, so long live Arbourg Oats. Well, the Parkland College and the East Central Research Foundation programs have received funding for summer student researchers, equipment, and other operational programs, $200,000 from the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council of Canada, known as NSERC. That story next. Well, for some years now, the Parkland Regional College has operated in partnership with the East Central Research Foundation, a farmer-driven entity which does local research as part of the provincial AgriArm network. AgriArm is 8 sites around the province: Prince Albert, Melfort, Outlook, Scott, Redvers, and Swift Current, as well as Yorkton, of course. Mike Hall is the research coordinator at Yorkton. He works in collaboration and through the Parkland Regional College.
That money goes to the college to help enhance the research farm. And so within that grant, you know, there's money there for some more summer students and Parkland College students in the fall, even may be able to help out, this sort of thing. And then there's items in there for bigger pieces of equipment. You know, we can get a seed can, a way wagon, potentially to do some off farm sites, you know, bigger farm site trials in the future, you know, an issue that a particular producer may have on their field, you know, we might be able to address that at a field scale level, you know, with a way wagon. There's money in there for land rental and some maintenance technician. And we also are looking we were looking to possibly do winter meetings and that sort of thing. Money from could be used from there. I think the, you know, there are a number of things in there that we're not sure if they're going ahead immediately, you know, in light of COVID-19. But I think, you know, the funding agencies will be a little lenient on when the money gets spent.
Well, obviously, COVID-19 has changed summer operations at the site, which is city-owned land. Use of it is donated annually.
Fortunately, you know, we've been able to continue operations. You know, it was a bit touch and go there for a while, but we got approval from the province and, you know, approval from the college. And we've had to make some changes to deal with COVID-19, that sort of thing. But, you know, we work outside, so for the most part, it's pretty easy to keep our distance from each other. And we've got, you know, a full program like normal. We're finished seeding right now, and we've started spraying some things. And there's a bit of a question mark, though, for, you know, what kind of tour, if any, we're going to have this year. I guess we'll just wait to see what kind of permission we get from the province and the college to conduct something. But if we don't have a physical tour, we're going to make a virtual one. You know, basically, we're going to do some touring through the plots and make a video out of it. And of course, you know, we've posted many videos at the ECRF website, which is just simply www.ecrf.ca. And so there's lots of videos there, and we'll post a virtual crop plot walk, I guess, from the summer if we can't have a face-to-face sort of event.
So maybe you could just give us an idea of some of the projects that you will be working on right on the site this year.
There's a number of continuing projects. You know, we're still working on a number of things. Like, you know, we have like the whole gamut of wheat, barley, oats, and we're doing dry beans again, like these blackstrap beans. And there's a pea trial out there, flax trial. So there's a number of trials, you know, and of course I'm still always interested in, you know, looking at comparisons of how to increase protein in wheat. So we're continuing on with some of the work that we've done with UAN and dissolved urea, because we've had a fair bit of interest in, you know, the kind of results that we have been obtaining from that. Actually, we're trying to dissolve some urea right now, but our water is pretty cold out there, and when you dissolve urea, it's an endothermic reaction and makes the water even colder. So they've had to stop trying to push this urea into the water here because things are getting a bit too cold out there right now. It's better to have warm, really warm water, you know, when you're trying to dissolve urea. But, you know, we've got malt barley, several malt barley trials again that we're continuing on, that's sort of building upon the work that we've done in the past. And I'm really curious to see what we get with our dry beans this year, because we had blackstrap dry beans last year, and you know, they're a legume, they're supposed to fix their own nightrogen, and we tried out a number of inoculants and none of them worked very well. It's pretty much nothing. And part of the problem is that, you know, you the host specificity can be really, really, really tight. And there's not a lot of interest from the industry to be making inoculants for these beans, because it's such a small market. But, you know, depending upon the situation, you know, they can be worth a fair bit of money. So, and other places of the world, they're not even inoculating them. They're just putting high rates of nitrogen down.
So that, again, a discussion with Mike Hall at the East Central Research Farm early this week. Well, next, Jack's excellent adventures in the bee yards. And for sure, Saturday was an excellent day for Jack to learn about bee culture 101.
These are drones, these bigger ones that
Oh, yeah?
Extend out. All the rest of those are worker bees. And this is what you see, right? You see, typically you'll see, there's not much honey on this frame, but often there'll be a kind of a section of cap brood, and then just outside it, there'll be pollen and then honey. And it's like here, you see it on this side, the pollen. See the colored nacelles there? The yellow and green. Okay. The cells that are recessed here that aren't capped,
yeah,
that's all pollen, and then the stuff that's glowing or reflecting is honey.
Yeah, oh, okay. Right. Now I get it, yeah.
So it looks good. She's looking good there. This one was really weak in the spring, and I wasn't sure if they were going to make it.
Well, as you can tell, that was a pretty windy Saturday, if you remember it, in a small but active bee yard with Stan Reed of Yorkton. Stan is a potash industry engineer and a hobbyist beekeeper who maintains just five hives, just outside the city.
I grew up, we had bees when I was a kid. My dad had, we probably had 6 to 10 hives. And we enjoyed taking care of them and taking the honey off. We weren't very good beekeepers. But then a couple of years ago, probably 6 or 8 years ago, a guy that I work with had a swarm that had infested his garage, and he was going to kill them. And I got all excited, and I said, hey, well, let's see if we can salvage these and put them in a box. And I was able to do that, but it was pretty late in the year. It was September, I think, early September. And I fed them as much as I could. The queen was laying eggs, but then they died off in the winter.
So what have you learned in these last few years as far as beekeeping?
This is a different environment than where I grew up.
You're from Indiana.
Yeah, and so here there's no nectar for probably 8 months of the year, right? Nectar doesn't start until very late May and probably dries up in August. So you have to be, in the fall, leave them enough stores so they can take care of themselves. But then in the spring, there's a dearth of nectar, and you have to make sure that you stay on top of it so they don't starve.
So where do you overwinter your bees?
In the field. Just wrap them four on a pallet, and then so two sides of each box would be insulated by an adjacent box, and then put a poly-filled wrap around them that insulates them. They don't get cold. I think they moisture is a bigger issue. You have to make sure that they don't get condensation in the hive that ends up dripping on them and cooling them off.
And how do you do that?
Vent it. So you have to have a vent at the top, which costs some heat, but it keeps the moisture down.
Mm. So do you have to open them up in the winter and feed them?
I don't do that, no. I don't open them. Maybe in a warm day in March if we get one, or sometimes in late February we'll get one that you can open them up and have a look and then maybe throw some feed in if they're light. Mm. If they go into the winter with two full brood boxes of honey, though, that probably won't be an issue.
When were you able to put the bees out this spring?
Probably the end of March, I unwrapped them just so I could get in and treat them for varroa mites, which is a parasite that's a big problem in beekeeping.
So then you had to feed them up until just recently?
I didn't have to. No. There was lots of honey in the hives from the winter. One of the hives starved because they didn't find that there was lots of honey in their hive. It didn't starve. They almost starved. Many of the bees I found low in the hive with their heads stuck in the cells trying to scrape out the honey. There was honey elsewhere in it, so they probably got cold and didn't move into the other section of the hive that had more honey. They didn't die, though. I've just a handful of bees left, but there is a queen, so I gave them some brood frames from some of the stronger hives, and they're coming along now.
The varroa mite problem, has that been over, or is it ever over?
I don't think it's ever over. Yeah. It's a perennial problem. So one of the things I know, I didn't treat them last year for mites in the spring, and then I counted them later in the summer toward the fall. So the count was higher than I want. The mites are a parasite, and it affects them because they get in with the brood, and then they can weaken the brood. You can get deformed bees that grow because of the mites, but they also bring in other diseases into the hives. So you really want to keep the mites under control. So this spring I did give them a miticide for the mites. Hmm.
So now you've developed some queens of your own?
I did graft a couple queens last year. They didn't mate, or they didn't make it after they mated, so I didn't get those. But I haven't done anything other than let the bees develop their own from like forcing them to do that when I split them.
What prompts the bees to swarm?
The spring is a big time when they get ready to swarm. If they run out of room in a hive, they'll That's the main issue, is they run out of room in their hive and then they swarm. So overpopulation of bees in a hive without enough space.
So what sort of honey production, you know, I think it's, is it 4 years now you've been doing it? How many pounds? Just give us a benchmark.
Well, I think the first year was the best with fresh queens. And I think we got about, I got about 200 pounds a hive. And then the last couple years have been a little less. We're learning as I go that you got to keep the queens fresh because they lay so many eggs in a season. Like a hive will go from, you know, like I say, this handful of bees is probably going to be 60,000 bees in another 2 months. And that queen is laying all those eggs. Mm-hmm. So they wear out. So I think the trick is to put new queens in every other year.
So once your friends find out you're producing honey, do they show up with a pail?
Yeah, we get rid of a lot of it that way. We give it to a lot of the teachers as gifts as well. So yeah, people seem to like it.
Yeah. So what's actually in honey that makes it so great, do you know?
Well, there's pollen in it, right? Yeah. So that's one of the things, is it's not filtered. Like raw honey that comes out of the hive, which is what a lot of people like, has a fair amount of pollen in it. Canola honey especially crystallizes on that pollen fairly quickly. We try to cream it, so introduce a crystals of a known size, or a small size, so that it doesn't crystallize real coarse. But honey's a mix of sugars and pollen.
You're a family man. What does your family think of your hobby?
Well, I have three daughters, and I'm trying to get them into it, but no real success yet. They help with the taking off of the honey, though, and the eating portion.
Yeah. How do you see it ahead? Do you think you'll keep expanding your hive count, or where are you going?
Well, this is lots more than we need to eat, so we either have to figure out how to get rid of more of it or keep it at this size or reduce it. But it's the challenge, I think, of trying to figure out how to make them productive, how to keep them healthy. I'd like to, down the road, be able to select them. Like, that's why I want to figure out how to graft the queens successfully, is to select them so that I can get strains that are more resistant to the mites, or maybe they, you know, higher production while they're still resistant to mites.
I meant to ask you, your location is just south of Yorkton. Have there been some threats to your hives, like from animals or otherwise? Have you had to deal with that kind of thing at all?
I haven't. I've put a fence up for skunks because that is a big problem with beehives. I know a friend of mine, Nathan Meyer, the guy from Priestville.
Yeah.
Skunks got into his, and they can decimate a hive very quickly. But no, I haven't had any issues. There's a gopher out there now, though, this year, I see. So I don't think he'll bother the bees, though.
So that, again, a conversation with Stan Reed. As you could hear, the bees were buzzing happily around us. Some of them weren't too happy, but it was a great afternoon. Appreciate Stan. Stan and his wife, Trish, as you heard, three daughters, very talented family. Well, it's on the land, and this is The Rock, and a new feature coming up on our website is going to be called On the Land on Demand, and my producer, Jordan Patswold, is the technical brains behind it. Jordan, how are we going to do this?
Well, like you say, Jack, through our Rock 98.5 website, you can find through our audio page available to listeners and those that enjoy listening to your program. On the Land on Demand, trying to keep it as simple as possible for folks to be able to go back and maybe keep up with some of the audio you provide week to week, day to day, with your 3 minute long feature, as well as this full hour program that you have here on Thursdays. And then as we expand and as you feel more and more comfortable with it, you might even be able to throw up there some bonus coverage, maybe if we're not able to get to it during this hour. As you often allude to, we often prepare so much and can't quite get to all of it, but there may be a resource and a page that people can access that will give them that opportunity to stay in tune with what you do broadcast and a little bit more that we can't get to.
Sounds simple when you explain it. And of course, for the no-tech old guy, it's going to be an interesting journey, but appreciate your help on it, Jordan. And just another good reason to remind our listeners that we appreciate any story ideas or from you. And we'll begin our, as I call it, muffins in the mud routine today. Not much mud, but Dennis Dick, our Rock manager, will be heading out to talk to some folks in the Bangor area, and we'll have a report on that for you next week, and well, stay tuned.